Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So right out of the box, we have an interesting email from Spain. Inez in Spain writes, "Good morning, Dr. Dawn. I'm writing about persistent chilblains. My name is Inez, and I'm a regular and grateful listener from Spain. I enjoy your podcast so much that I've been listening to it for years, starting before you changed from KUSP to the actual station you're currently on. I really appreciate not only your vast knowledge, but also your interest in promoting prevention and good habits as the key for good health. The help and support you give us, not only through your program topics, but also personalized attention and phone calls and emails, is invaluable." And so Inez has decided to go after some of that personal attention, and she brings us a very interesting problem. Continuing with Inez, "I am 55 years old woman with healthy eating habits and regular exercise. In the last 20 years, starting at the age of 35, I've experienced more than 10 episodes of pneumothorax and have been surgically treated for that." Pneumothorax, for my audience, is a collapsed lung. "I've also had an early menopause at 37 and have mild osteoporosis due to low body weight. Apart from high cholesterol, total cholesterol is 239, LDL is 104, all of my blood tests are normal, and so is my blood pressure. Last winter, I sporadically suffered from chilblains in my toes, nothing very serious, so I really didn't bother much and treated them just with hygienic measures and patience. But this winter, I have more painful and persistent chilblains in the hands and feet. Is there any treatment apart from corticoids to accelerate healing once they establish? Any preventative measures you can recommend me? I have never suffered from chilblains before and really don't understand the reason for them, as winters in Spain are not really too cold. I know COVID has been proposed as a possible cause, and I have been infected several times in the last 2 years, but nothing too serious or different from a flu-like scene. Any help or advice is welcome. Even though it is not an important disease, pain and itching are sometimes uncomfortable and limiting. Your thankful listener, Inez." Well, folks, I'm going to start off with just a brief definition of chilblains. Sometimes these are also called pernio, and they are painful red bumps typically forming on the toes and the digits, typically on the back of the hands and the top of the feet. Statistically, they're associated with low temperatures, damp weather, and I did a little researching around and have some information to share with you. What we think is going on is vasoconstriction caused by the cold weather, so the small blood vessels in the toes and hands constrict, and that cuts off the oxygen and the glucose to the tissue downstream from that spasm, and those starved tissues sustain an injury, similar in a way to a crush injury, but an ischemic injury. For example, if you left a tourniquet on too long, that could cause ischemic energy to the downstream tissues. This tissue injury is interesting in the sense that it does recover. It takes a few weeks, but we'll get to this in a minute. The natural history of this when COVID is involved may be a little bit different. In many ways, Inez, you are a poster child for getting pernio. You have low body weight and you're a woman. I am very struck by the fact that you've had 10 pneumothorax episodes, and I'm assuming these are spontaneous. You mentioned that you are healthy, and I'm assuming that means that you don't smoke and don't have COPD, which is actually the most common cause of this. So as a functional medicine doctor, the first thing I think about is what is maybe genetically different about this woman that makes her much more vulnerable to pneumothorax? And the first place my mind goes is collagen variations. Obviously, if you had emphysema, another risk factor for pneumothorax, your doctors would have mentioned that to you. And since you don't mention that in the letter, I'm dismissing that possibility. But some sort of genetic variation or possibly a tendency towards autoimmune disease would be the next thing I would ask you. So I'd be asking you if you're really flexible and can do the splits at 55, or whether or not you can touch your thumb to the inside part of your wrist. Those are signs of hyperflexibility. And collagen, of course, is one of the things that's helping hold the lungs together. But let's move on to your question about the perineo. I did a little research, and initially I want to just remind everyone that COVID blocks the ACE2 receptors on the surface of cells. And this ACE2 blockage is permanent. It's caused by the COVID virus actually attaching to the ACE2 receptors, and your vasculature, your blood vessels do contain that. This damage has a long duration of action. So essentially, you've lost your fire extinguisher for inflammation when this ACE2 receptor is trashed by the virus, and it takes a long time for it to come out. And this may account for why there's a lot of debate still, 3 years later, about the actual, 4 years really, the actual source of this association between chilblains and COVID, because the doctors looked for antibodies, but they didn't find them. I'll come to why that may not be a reason to discount the association, which is actually pretty significant. So this is a study that was published in France, and I'll just briefly say this was looking at patients referred to five hospitals between March and May of 2020, so early on, and 82% of these patients with chilblains recovered, but 27% of them had persistent changes, mostly blueness, what we call acrocyanosis, and also Raynaud's phenomenon developing in individuals who presented during COVID. Now, what's significant here is that chilblains are not commonly associated with persistent symptoms. You may get them again, but there aren't other changes that occur in the fingers. So for Inez, I would be asking her, if we were having a conversation, whether her fingers tend to be bluer than they used to be, whether she notices when it's cold that she'll get numb on the tips of her fingers, with or without developing the perineo. And in this article, there was a fascinating finding, which is basically about a third of the people who had chilblains during that first lockdown period, remember that was March to May of 2020, evolved their acral manifestations during summer. Raynaud's phenomenon showing up in summer would be odd, because Raynaud's vasospasm tends to be associated with cold weather. But this persistent cyanosis is very unusual. And what the researchers postulate, and I want to say this is a hypothesis, hence the verb postulate, be somewhat difficult to prove, but they postulate that because SARS-CoV was so terribly inflammatory that people got a very strong antiviral response and put out a lot of interferon. Interestingly, there are a few rare diseases where high levels of interferon, a chemical that is very highly inflammatory and essentially attacks bacteria, viruses, whatever you've got, very effectively. In pathological release of interferon, you do see exactly these same changes that are observed. Chilblains, among other things, one of the hallmarks of elevated interferon, and acrocyanosis and Raynaud phenomenon actually have been reported when people are given interferon alpha for medical reasons. Like, for example, we use interferon beta in the treatment of, and the curative treatment, I might add, of persistent hepatitis C. So this prolonged, what if the interferon-driven immunological response doesn't turn off because the ACE2 is missing and unable to turn it off. In certain individuals with certain setups, let's call them antecedents, which could be something acquired or something inherited, they have a higher risk of this. It also implicates this high interferon release probably with long COVID. So thank you. Now, Inez wanted some advice. And so anti-inflammatory therapy, we're going to spend some time talking about things that you can use that have anti-inflammatory properties in the vasculature. And top of the list is fish oil. I don't know how many sardines in Inez is eating with her tapas, but sardines are an excellent choice of omegas. I'd probably recommend at least 2,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acid on a regular daily basis, along with a vascular anti-inflammatory that you're probably familiar with, which is green tea. Now, green tea extract, it would be one capsule containing about 200 to 500 milligrams, or you could just drink a pot of strong green tea every day, and that would be very helpful from an anti-inflammatory standpoint. Unfortunately, Inez, I have no suggestions for how you can avoid future pneumothorax, but I presume that you said when you had surgery that that had been curative, and I certainly hope so. We have an email from Judy, and Judy writes, what can be done about the fact that no doctors are accepting new Medicare patients? Yes, let's talk about Medicare for just a moment, Judy. Essentially, the employers of most of the doctors, at least in my county, lose money on Medicare patients. Medicare's reimbursement for primary care services has actually declined, and yet the demand for Medicare services with the aging of the population is causing a real crash and burn. So people are trying massively to churn out physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, and other people who basically simply don't have as much lead time for the production of the healthcare provider. And I do believe that I have great respect for physician assistants and nurse practitioners, family nurse practitioners in particular. They have excellent expertise and can definitely deal with the wellness issues and the management of chronic disease that is the backbone of primary care. And we need more physicians extenders. We need more doctors. It's absolutely true. It just takes a long time to bake them is the issue. What can be done? Increase the reimbursement. Provide doctors and their employers, I might add, because if you're on your own, you can make your own decision about what to do around Medicare. But if you're an employee, you don't have that decision. You work for an entity, and that entity makes the call. And it's very, very difficult to get a corporation to lose money on purpose. And that's a problem. Medicare is in the middle of, right now, the legislation is to cut doctors' reimbursement by 4%. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, hospitals' reimbursement is going up. And I'm not saying that it shouldn't, but I am saying that shooting the doctors in the feet right now at a time when there's a shortage and expecting them not to pick up their marbles and go home and say, sorry, I'm closing my practice to new Medicare. This is called financial survival for a lot of practices. And I don't blame them, but I don't know what else to say, but talk to your congressman, make a noise, demand that somebody come up with some money to reimburse people for opening their practices so that they can at least break even on Medicare patients. God love you. You tend to be complicated. You tend to be a little more time consuming statistically in terms of your needs. There's nothing wrong with that. except that the reimbursement is less than the reimbursement that we get for younger people, which is crazy, upside down, backwards, and nuts. We've got a call. Let's go ahead and pick up the call. Hello, this is Dr. Don.
Listening to you, I'm a monthly contributor to KSTD. I've been listening to you for a very long time. Now this Medicare thing comes up. I'm in my 80s, and I'm on Medicare. How do I get you as my doctor?
Well, you can get me as your doctor, but you'll have to actually pay me a fee. Because Medicare, I opted out of Medicare about a decade ago, I felt I did my duty. I let myself be cheated for 24 years, and that was long enough. And it was just getting worse, and it was getting to the point where, in order to make ends meet and pay my staff, I was going to have to stop spending what I perceived to be the amount of time that patients needed with the patients, or find another way to fund the practice of medicine. I'm not expensive. You can go to my website, or you can call my office and discuss how you might come see me. You can look me up in the phone book, but I'm allowed to give my phone number out, so I'm going to. And that number is 831-421-0197.
421-0197.
You got it.
Zero.
All right. Okay. Good luck to you, sir. I look forward to hearing from you. What's your name?
Richard Harrington.
Richard, and, I'll tell my office manager to look out for you.
You're so aware of so much involved. Acupuncture, you know, I mean, the doctors I've been to are completely worthless.
Oh, don't say that. They're trying really hard in a difficult situation. So give them a little credit.
They give me a bunch of pills. And
all right, Richard. Good luck.
Okay.
Give me a call and let's see. Okay. We'll see what we can
Thank
do
you.
For you.
Bye bye.
Bye bye. So, Irana in Santa Cruz writes. I guess it's Ronnie. Thanks, and my left thigh pain. Thanks again for your great program and for being there for all of us. I doubt if you will be able to help me. Oh, I love it when it starts like that. Now I'm challenged. As I've been to several practitioners who've helped me in the past, a non-force chiropractor 3 times, a body worker, and finally a smart PA, since my regular doctor is not available for a while, who ordered some tests and an x-ray, see below. I have an appointment with a physiatrist next week, but becoming pretty discouraged. My blood tests look fine. My x-rays show some mild degenerative disc disease and grade 1 anterolisthesis at 4-5 and L5-S1. And nobody thinks that this should be causing this sudden ongoing pain or has an idea of the cause. I figure you may have some interesting ideas, which might help. You never know. So for the past 9 to 10 weeks, I have a problem with my left thigh. I can't walk on it after I'm lying down for a while. Usually this is after a night of sleeping, as I don't normally lay down in the day. It's quite an intense pain all over my thigh, and it seems somewhat deep. I find I can walk if I bend over, and it helps a lot to put my left arm above my knee as I walk. Now that is an important clue. We'll come back to that in a moment. The pain is a function of how long I've been lying down. The shorter period of time I lie down or even sit, the less the pain, and the shorter the time it takes to lessen. It takes at least an hour or so in the morning until I can walk normally with little pain after getting up. However, it remains intense if I lie down and try to roll over. In other words, not getting out of bed and trying to walk. It's always waiting there to get me if I'm not careful and move it wrong. Another aspect, my left arm is somewhat involved. In the morning, it causes much pain in my thigh when I raise my arm or reach it behind my back. Now it's the middle of the day and there's no problem. Good news is that I'm able to walk almost pain-free after a while, so I guess things could be a lot worse. I've been looking at my PANTH doctor's records of this and thinking you might want to know more to get more of an idea, so perhaps I will email this note to you now. If you get a chance on Wednesday evening to address this, and it would help if you saw the PANTH results, maybe I could call in and tell you more. I'll be listening anyway. And thank you, Dr. Don, for any ideas you may have. P.S., I also have some vein issue in the calves, which doesn't seem related, but I thought to mention it. So, Ronnie, as I was reading this, and this happens to me a lot, it's not a visual hallucination. It's just the way that my smart brain thinks. My smart brain is nonverbal, and so it paints me pictures. And so what I saw was I saw a marionette whose strings had gotten tangled. And so when you pull up, when you lift the part of the that little T-shaped bar on the marionette and you lift it up and it's supposed to raise the right arm, instead it was raising the right arm and the left leg because the strings had gotten tangled. You need to go see an osteopathic doctor because they are the people who know their fascia. They go to school and they learn about this organ that none of the rest of us really learn about. For one thing, you really can't see it when you dissect a cadaver. Fascia and the interstitial fluid, the sole as it's called, is sort of like that pink stuff when you open a can of ham. That's kind of, it's a lot of collagen, but it dissolves if you heat it. And at body temperature, this stuff is a dynamic fluid. This is part of what we use when we're doing acupuncture. I know about fascia and its importance because you can tug on it with acupuncture. There's little tiny fibrils, but they're in solution like threads. But if there's an inflammation, they get sticky. So what I've told you is basic structure. Now let's talk about the macro structure. We have these internal dynamic fascial interconnections. So your thigh is literally connected directly to your left arm through these fascial interconnections. And when these things are working well, they're nice and stretchy and rubbery, and they help hold you together, but they don't hold you back. Now, for me, the real clue was when you said, if you put your arm on the knee on that side, that lets you walk bent over. You're tethered. And as you move around and warm yourself up, the canned ham pink stuff liquefies and turns into a normal kind of fascial interconnection. The problem is something has tangled this up. It's inflammation. It's like a Rastafarian braid. It needs to be teased apart and massaged loose and opened up. And that's the skill, the secret sauce of osteopathy. So I'm very pleased to say that the residency program that we're currently creating as we speak, I was there all day creating, we are going to be able to train our doctors in basic osteopathy. And if they want to get advanced certification, they will have that option. Everyone who knows about this stuff thinks that we need to move this into the mainstream, that we need to move osteopathic care, and for that matter, a certain amount of acupuncture knowledge into mainstream medicine because it's so useful in the areas where basically our therapeutic armamentarium comes up dry. We don't have anything that fixes fascia, and all we can do is throw pills at it, which have side effects and don't get to the root problem, which if you happen to be someone who's a manufacturer of pills, is just how you like it. You'd rather patch than fix. And I'd rather fix than patch. So we have a basic non-meeting of the minds there philosophically. That doesn't mean I won't use a patch when I need it, but it does mean I don't stop there. And you need to find yourself a good osteopathic doctor. There are a number of them in town. I would suggest that you just search that and start calling around, because I'm pretty sure that with some therapy in that direction, they'll find the answer, figure out where they need to rub, push, and pinch, and get you into a better place. And let's go to our next caller. Hello, this is Dr. Don. You're on the air.
Dr. Don, I have two questions, quick answers, quick questions. One is the nutritional value of radishes.
Okay. Well, let's start with vitamin A, vitamin C. They have other carotenoids, which are extremely important. There's some lutein in there. There's a lot of fiber, which is an excellent source. And I'd have to look it up to tell you what the mineral content was. But I will tell you, your microbiome will love you.
All right.
Root vegetables in general, the microbiome gets a big happy face, and the bacteria you want multiply, and the bacteria that you don't want get a real sad face and slink away because they only like sugar.
Well, I don't want sad faces. Anyway, thank you. That's comprehensive what I needed to know. And the second question is a big one. Aluminum. I know I've long ago been told, oh, don't cook in aluminum. That's one thing. But how about all the soda drinks and so forth that kids and adults drink from aluminum cans? You know what I'm saying, soda?
I sure do. And aluminum is funny. You know, we used to think back when we were first studying Alzheimer's, we would find aluminum in Alzheimer's plaques, and that was the source of the oh my gods. Turns out Alzheimer's plaques are like that screen in the bottom of your drain that catches all the particles and hair and fibers. And, you know, when you go look, whatever you want to look for in an Alzheimer's plaque, you're going to find it. Anything that the immune system would be irritated by, which is all metals, because these have a charge attached to them, and the immune system thinks they're bacterial cell walls, so it attacks the metals for the most part, with the possible exception of internal silver, which seems not to do this, can irritate tissues. Of course, things like arsenic and lead have really bad effects because they are toxic to the mitochondria. By the way, what they do is they get in the way of your body's ability to make energy. Pretty basic toxic. So aluminum is, quote-unquote, biologically inert. When you talk about cans, the thing that bugs me about the cans, quite honestly, is the plastic lining inside the cans. Which,
oh, really?
Yeah. Because
they all have them?
Yeah, they pretty much all have them.
Oh!
And the microplastics that kind of peel off, particularly if it's a soda can, because then you've got this, well, aluminum has a taste, basically, a little bit of a taste. So they line it with plastic, and then it doesn't etch from the acid in the carbonic acid, which is what's in soda, right? That's what makes it bubble. So you've got acid, you've got etching. That's not good. Affects the flavor over time. So they line them in plastic. Now you etch the plastic, which is flavorless, microscopic, and very, very small little particles have gotten into our body, and basically we're all carrying around now a plastic load. In fact, one of the things I was going to talk about on the program today was plastic, but I'll let you ask any follow-up questions you have while I do.
That was interesting. I learned more about and I didn't know about the plastic there. About, you mentioned, I don't know if you mentioned gold, but silver. I've heard of a thing called colloidal silver, and it's good for you. What's that all about?
Well, silver has some really interesting properties. Both copper and silver are really deadly to bacteria. So it is, and viruses. It damages their surface so that they essentially are inactivated. When COVID was going on and we were trying to figure out, you know, what we could do, one of the things that some people did was they started putting copper screening in the ventilator systems, because whatever touched that copper was deactivated. Silver, when it's colloidal, it's been broken down into tiny microscopic fragments. And I use a lot of colloidal silver in my practice.
In your what?
In my medical practice.
What, your instruments?
Well, no. Actually, I use standard sterilization procedures for my instruments. But I have people spray colloidal silver in their nose when a family member has a cold and they're trying not to get it.
Oh.
I take it myself when I'm on an airplane. If I'm going to be flying, every 2 or 3 hours, I give myself a squirt of colloidal silver, because firstly, it hydrates my mucus, which means that I've got a barrier from the viruses I'm inhaling.
Right.
Secondly, it's toxic to the viruses. Some
people,
I use it in people with chronic sinusitis. I have them wash out their nose with it, and you can buy a little electrical thing that will, and some pure silver, what's called, there's a term in jewelry. I forget it. But anyway, you put silver into a a solution by running electricity. It's an electrolytic process. And then you have colloidal silver. And it is, some people drink it. I don't recommend that. It's very good for washing out wounds and for people who are allergic to topical antibiotics. And in the burn unit, where people lose large chunks of skin, and they're at extremely high risk of sepsis, blood poisoning, from any bacteria getting into the burn, they use silver. It's called silvadine. It's a white, it looks like a white Vaseline, but it's full of silver, and it is the antibacterial of choice because nothing, get this, nothing has yet managed to be resistant to silver.
So what you're saying is I should move to Nevada, central Nevada, and start mining silver. That's a good idea.
Oh, I don't know. I think I'd hit the flea market and buy up all that used sterling that's floating around. You know?
Well, there's no flea market in Santa Cruz anymore.
Oh, I just have to drive to San Jose. They got a couple of them.
Oh, that's right. Oh, well, that's why I listen to the show so religious, not religious, but anyway, attentively, because I learn a lot about stuff I didn't even think about.
Well, you know, today I was listening, I was on a Zoom, and I was listening to a doctor, and he was talking to us. He's way off in Atlanta. He's at Morehouse. And he called what we do as physicians, he called it a ministry.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if I guess it must be a ministry if people listen to me religiously, right?
All righty. Well, I know you have other callers waiting or texters, so I really appreciate your show as usual, and you answered the two questions I've been having.
Well, very good. And when we come back after the break, I'll talk a little bit about what I learned about plastics in food, because it's pretty scary. So don't go away.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Plastic chemicals in foods, and this was a consumer report that came out. I believe it was sent to me by my Boswell, I like to call him, who's a patient of mine, David, who sends me tons of articles and asks really astute scientific questions in the office. Definitely keeps me on my toes, and I appreciate that. So in this article, they listed a bunch of different beverages, and the total amount of phthalate, that's a type of microplastic, that's a type of plastic that filters into food. Phthalate is a substance that is often used or used to be used in baby pacifiers. So you can imagine the amount of phthalate they were getting. And a study came out about 10 years ago that showed that phthalates were hormone mimics. And in fact, they basically measured the distance between the anus and the base of the penis in baby boys, newborn baby boys, and they found that the higher the level of phthalate in the mother's, in the cord blood that was feeding from the placenta into the baby, because, you know, when you clamp the cord, you've got this nice tube of blood, you send it off for testing. What they found was that the phthalate levels correlated really well with the shortening of that distance. And by the way, that distance is one of the primary sexual characteristics during embryological development. If you're going to be a boy, that distance increases. If you're going to be a girl, by the way, all humans start off as female physiognomy down there. But if you're going to convert to a boy and develop a penis, well, that lengthening occurs. That lengthening doesn't happen as well. And we're turning out now, that was 10 years ago, we're looking at some fertility studies, and we're seeing that fertility in men, directly related to the appearance of their sperm and all the scoring that we do, so number, how swimmy they are, whether they look normal, all those things. Guess what? Phthalate levels again. And maybe we should have people take phthalate as a male birth control pill, because it certainly seems to reduce fertility. So I've been telling guys, boxer shorts and stay away from plastics. But even a can, like a can of Coca-Cola, you're going to have 3,000 nanograms of plastic, but not all cans, right? And here's a plastic bottle, that's 1,700. Here's apple juice in plastic. Here's natural spring water, Poland Spring, 100% natural spring water in plastic, 4,000. Lipton ice green tea citrus plastic, Old Original Coca-Cola in plastic, 7,000, and Brisk Iced Tea, 7,000. Canned beans coming in at between 3,000 and 10,000, all reasonably high. But the weird thing is it varies a lot from product to product. So, for example, Mrs. Butterworth, oh no, Mrs. Butterworth, 1,000, whereas Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce, only 22. A lot of those protein shakes, very high levels, as much as 20,000 in some of them. And salted butter in a paper, in cardboard, still 500. Cheese, anything that's fatty, by the way, really, you want it wrapped in paper. I'm starting to see more and more cheeses at markets wrapped in wax paper, which isn't plastic. And because the plastic things love to migrate, they'll migrate into the cheese. So I'm actually obsessive enough about this that I trim my cheese just with a little wire. If it's standard supermarket cheese and I know it's been sitting in plastic for a while. When you look at fast food, the numbers go up into the 20,000s. Crispy chicken nuggets that are served in paper, but they're 33,000 units of nanograms of phthalates per serving. So what does that tell you? It tells you it's about the processing. More clues when we look at these highly processed foods. Somehow, during the processing, plastic's getting into the food. So it doesn't matter whether they give it to you in a cardboard container if it went through processing in plastic materials. You know, Cheerios has 10,000 per serving, but Cheerios is a highly processed food. It used to be wheat a long time ago. Then it got ground up. Then it got turned into a paste. Then it got cooked. Then it got blown through, the air blown into it and extruded and bounced around to bake it. And a lot of plastic it came into contact with during that process. And this plastic, particularly phthalate, it's a hormone mimic, right? Why are we seeing so much obesity? Well, yeah, it is sort of the fast food that our diet has been transformed into, but it's not the food as much as the way it's made. So it's got to be the processing. Annie's Organic Cheesy Ravioli in a can wins the prize at 53,579 nanograms of plastic per serving. So think about that. It's ravioli. It's goes through a roller. It goes through a chopper. It's got a cheesy substance. Who knows how that was stored? Who knows how it was cut? Who knows a lot of things about the prep, except that somewhere along the way, a whole heck of plastic got into it. And microplastics and phthalates are going to show up together in the same sorts of situations. Actually, I was pretty surprised. Seafood, with the exception of one brand of pink salmon chicken of the sea, was awful at 24,000. But wild-caught sardines, 7,000, not too bad. And there were other tunas that came in quite low, including tunas in a plastic pouch. So go figure. It's got to be the processing. So my best advice to people who want to keep their microplastic levels low, number one, water. Don't buy water in plastic bottles unless you're dying of thirst. You're better off, honest to God, I believe, with tap water at this point. And if you are going to buy water in plastic bottles, like a large supply of it, where the plastic bottle is large, decant it into glass bottles so at least it won't continue to absorb plastic. But most importantly, learn to cook. Much of what we know is wrong, but one of the things that we do know is that all of the chronic diseases we're seeing, all of the epidemic of obesity, the epidemic of diabetes, I will tell you, an epidemic is something that you catch. I used to argue against the use of the term because I said this is a chronic disease and you acquire it, but you don't catch it. Well, now I'm beginning to wonder, if maybe epidemic isn't the right word. But this isn't an epidemic we're going to solve with a drug. This is a epidemic that we're going to solve with a behavior chain. To quote Michael Pollan, eat food, mostly plant. Avoid food-like objects. And that would include, I'm sorry to say, goldfish and Cheetos. This one from Cheryl. And Cheryl writes, is there an episode of your podcast where you discuss electrolyte powders? I'm looking for some clarification of what I should use. I'm wanting unsweetened and looking for a good value for an effective product. So, Cheryl, you mentioned effective product. And so I'm going to ask you, effective for what? What's your goal here? Is your goal improved hydration? Or is your goal electrolyte placement after vigorous exercise? Because you know what the advice I just give about that I just gave about avoiding plastics, eat food, mostly plants. That same advice applies here, especially if you buy the plants in a recognizable form. You know, this is a carrot. It came out of the ground. It may still even have some dirt on it. I probably want to scrub it before eating it. That kind of food. So for electrolyte replacement after vigorous exercise, eating vegetables. If you don't want to eat them, a vegetable juice. Based on what I've just said, maybe you should make the juice yourself. But you could just have a baggie of some carrots, maybe some cucumber slices, some celery. And here's the trick. You've got all the potassium and magnesium you need in those vegetables inside the cells. Now, you want to throw a little extra salt and a little extra potassium in there if we're replacing after vigorous exercise. So you just get normal table salt and you get the salt substitute. Morton Salt makes one, and there's a company called New Salt that makes one. And that's potassium chloride. And you just make up a half and half blend of sodium chloride and potassium chloride and just salt your vegetables to taste. Have a little munch and you will absorb those electrolytes. Just chew them up well and drink a little water, and those electrolytes are going to get into your system as quickly as a commercial electrolyte powder, especially without the baggage, right? Because an electrolyte powder is essentially a processed food. It's got flavor. It's got things that consumers at a taste test at a focus group said, oh, I like this one best. That's not the stuff you want to be putting in your body. That's the stuff they're putting in their stuff to get you to want to put it in your body. And it's at best harmless and at worst dangerous. Okay. We have 10 minutes. Time to tell an interesting tale. I've got some case studies here and sort of curiosity of medicine. Not that relevant anymore, but certainly conceptually really important. So you probably have heard of Alzheimer's disease, and you may know that there are two types: sporadic cases that usually occur in people over 65, and much rarer, familial ones that are associated with a handful of mutations that run in families. These are typically mutations in the beta amyloid molecule. And in these unfortunate individuals, symptoms can begin in the patient's 30s. The name Alzheimer's is actually named after Dr. Alzheimer, who in the 19th century detailed a case report of a woman, 42 years old, who had clear dementia, no memory, and he studied her and eventually, I believe, he dissected her after she died. But the point is, old Alzheimer's, sporadic dementia, those were known unremarkable conditions throughout human history. This kind of dementia was unusual enough to be written up in a medical journal. But a recent paper, we've got the familial type, happens early. We've got the rarer sporadic cases. We're still arguing over the triggers of that. Is it aluminum? Is it beta amyloid? I will say that our animal models, focus on beta amyloid because that was the familial Alzheimer's. So they thought it was all Alzheimer's was due to a beta amyloid problem. We've based an entire, I don't know how many billions of dollars of research we've spent trying to find a drug that attacks beta amyloid and helps humans with the sporadic Alzheimer's. And we've still not hit our slam dunk. Barely statistically significant and super expensive and not worth it. Just not worth it. This paper, published in Nature Medicine back in January, describes five people with early onset Alzheimer's who didn't have that DNA. In fact, they caught Alzheimer's from human growth hormone that they were given as children. I need to go into the Wayback Machine and remind you that when children have dwarfism or they're short for their age, there's a great desire on the parents to see them grow. Some people have a congenital absence of growth hormone. And if they're going to reach anything resembling a healthy height, let alone, which is not about cosmetics, this is about not having your organs all squished together and living a normal duration, they needed that growth hormone. So it was not, it's non-trivial, but there was no place to get it except the brains of cadavers. So between 1959 and 1985, around 30,000 people around the world were given injections of human growth hormone. And some of those cadavers, some of the brains were contaminated with Jacob Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is a fatal neurodegenerative condition. And we all know about mad cow disease because that happened in the 90s. This was a molecular variant of this disease. Researchers since the 80s had been researching this disease and proved in the 80s that it wasn't caused by a bacteria or a virus, but by a new kind of infectious molecule, an infectious defective protein. We all know about protein folding at this point. The protein spools out of the ribosome, and then it has to fold up, and it folds up in exactly the right way due to the positive and negative charges on it, and also to the presence of certain shepherding molecules, mostly small microRNA fragments, that kind of keep it aligned so that it can harden up in the proper shape. A misfolded protein not only doesn't work, but it can also be impossible for the body to break down. So it once it misfolds, it stays in the tissue like sludge. And that's essentially what happens in Alzheimer's, is accumulation of beta amyloid and tau protein. In the case of cause and effect and whether the amyloid is a symptom, we're going to leave that one aside. But so the researchers in 2015, doing more research, they found in some of these brains of people who had died of premature Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, they found beta amyloid. And so they looked a little deeper and they found that if you give misfolded beta amyloid, it can act like a prion and actually create, apparently, infectious Alzheimer's. They went back and they found untouched samples of human growth hormone that had been in storage since the 80s and found that they contained amyloid beta. So they gave that to mice and the mice developed clumps of amyloid beta and behavioral symptoms consistent with Alzheimer's. They also found that three people who'd received grafts of cadaveric dura mater, that is to say the surface of the brain, like the skin on the brain, the meninges, if you will, the top meninges is called the dura mater, which in Latin, amusingly enough, translates into the hard mother. Anyway, they found three people who'd received grafts of that who had developed something called cerebral amyloid angiopathy, which is also a beta amyloid accumulation disease. They developed it on the surface of their brains because that's where the transplants were. But it suggests the same sort of thing. There are now eight cases, six of whom are still living, and indeed developed signs of Alzheimer's between the age of 38 and 55. None of them had the mutations of the familial source of the disease, but all of them received human growth hormone treatments. Now, we can't go back and test their specific HGH because the bottles weren't stored. This is no longer a problem in that these days the HGH is made synthetically, and again, human dermatographs have been taken out of line. But the thing about prions is they can survive being in an autoclave. Germs and viruses can't survive that. Question is whether there's any way to sterilize instruments or whether this, and we need to, I'm assuming that the neurosurgeons are looking carefully at this. It's certainly rare, but as we start getting into these brain implants, we talked about that a few weeks ago, actually about a month ago now, the brain implants themselves, besides having, you know, the ability to make paralyzed people walk and help people live more fulfilled lives, we definitely want to know what we're doing when we start messing around with brain tissue. And I just can't stress enough the fascination, and it's kind of the morbid fascination, I will admit, that I have feel for this story. So ending on a little bit of a Adams Family note, this is Dr. Don saying so long, stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.